touch my lips, touch their hearts. May you be glorified. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. It was a cool, clear morning, and I was doing what I do every workday morning. I was taking the stairs up to my office. The time I'm going to talk about today, my office was on the top floor of a six-story building, and so I was working my way up the stairs to the law school. I'm on the third floor, so I was normally working my way up the stairs in the morning. How many of you take the stairs? Good. Good. For those of you on this side who didn't raise your hand, it's free exercise. It's there. You don't have to go anywhere. You can just do it. And if you say, what, Larry?
I love technology.
Here's the thing, Larry. The elevator, at least at the law school, is not faster than I am. So you don't even waste any time. So I was going up the stairs at the office, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation office in Springfield, Virginia. The office sits right on the Beltway. If you know anything about Washington, D.C., there's a freeway that goes around the Capitol. It's called the Beltway, and the foundation's Right to Work building sits right there on the freeway. It's not that far from the Pentagon. This morning as I'm walking along in the stairwell, there is a concussion. I'm thinking, what's with that? I mean, they're not normally explosions here, you know, at the nation's capital. What is going on? So I continued my way up, and I was headed to a staff meeting. And when I got into the room where the staff was meeting, the lawyers were sitting around a television. They were glued to the television. Friends, I didn't really know that we had a television in the office. We never watched television during a staff meeting, yet all the lawyers were there looking at this picture, among others. And the news said that the Twin Towers had been hit by planes, it seemed, and the picture of the Pentagon showed, it appeared to me and I suppose everyone else, it had been bombed. And I wandered over to my office and I sat down, and no one knew anything. All the cell phones were down, and I was thinking, who could bomb the Pentagon? What nation on earth would attack the Pentagon? And I became convinced, as I thought about it, that any second, within minutes at least, nuclear weapons were going to be coming across. I figured I was living the last few moments of my life. And I thought that if I managed to survive, my life would never be the same. Well, we all know what happened now, right? But friends, this is what I call a moment in life. A moment that you just don't forget. You're not going to forget it as long as you live. Well, I've had several moments in life. I'll tell you about this moment in just a minute. A few weeks ago, I was talking to the pastor after a meeting. We're just standing there in the dark chatting, and we started talking about my cases. Now, whose fault would that be? Who knows? But I started telling him about some cases that I've litigated in the past. And he said, Bruce, he said, you have to preach a sermon where you tell these stories to the church. I said, well, that's easy, telling stories to the church. What could be better than that? I love to tell stories. And so he said, you need to do that. He said, because I don't think people really understand, and I think they will be inspired by these stories. So we'll see. That is me 44 years ago, my first day at work at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Friends, I went to law school and I had one motive and one motive only, and that was to work for God. Truly, I went to law school to go work for the church. And so my second year of law school, I was sending letters around to the divisions of the church saying, hey, you know, I'm going to a great school, I got great grades, I'm willing to work cheap, the important part, right? How about hiring me? And they all wrote back respectful letters saying, lawyer? Why would we need a lawyer? And so I thought, well, how is this going to work? You know, I wanted to work for the church, and no one at the church wants to hire me. So I thought, well, maybe I can work for an organization that litigates religious liberty issues. And frankly, I'd rather work on religious liberty than do some sort of, you know, corporate work for the church. And so the two big religious liberty issues for the church at that time were Sabbath work, right? Adventists being fired because they wouldn't work on Sabbath. And the other area, less known, was employees, members of the church being fired because they wouldn't join or financially support a labor union. Now, the church has always had the position on Sabbath. We are, after all, the Seventh-day Adventist church. Sabbath is a day of worship, a holy day. Work is incompatible with that. But the lesser known thing about union membership is something that's been taught. Ellen White talked about this, you know, 100 years ago. And there are the church in the 40s actually took a formal position on it. So those were the two issues. So I had my eyes open to see what I could do. And in the office of the law school, the placement office, was a letter from a guy named Rex Reed. And he was the executive vice president for something called the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I had never heard of it. What is that? You know? But he said that what we do is we give free legal aid to employees who want to stand apart from a union. I said, bingo. That's the religious liberty issue. And so I contacted them, and they flew me up there and hired me. And I said to them, here's what I want to do. I want to litigate on behalf of employees who have religious objections. They litigate on behalf of all sorts of employees, whatever your reason. But I said, I'm particularly concerned about those whose faith is being compromised. And you know what they said to me? Knock yourself out. So I've been knocking myself out for the past 43 years working on this. Now, what's involved? Well, there's a federal statute. It's called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it requires almost every employer and almost every union in the United States to attempt to accommodate the employee's religious beliefs, unless it would create an undue hardship. So what does that mean? If you've got a religious belief and work somehow conflicts with your beliefs, the employer, the union, they have to attempt to work out an accommodation. And so that's the law, and that's the one I've been litigating under. You can see I've changed quite a bit in 43 years. Look at how thin that guy is, you know. So that has been my primary work. I've litigated First Amendment cases as well, but that's the primary work. And these days, as some of you know, I'm teaching at the Regent University School of Law, still litigating for the foundation. These days I teach about employment discrimination, among other things. So I want to talk to you about moments in my career which have really stood out to me as God's grace, God's faithfulness. And the first one I want to talk to you about is Matthew Gray. Matthew Gray and his wife came to see me years ago in the Manassas Church. I believe they knew I was a lawyer. And they came to me, this young couple, they'd just gotten married. And he told me that he was an air traffic controller. He was just starting his career. What a great picture. You know, this young couple starting their life together. He's starting his career together. And he told me that it was important to him not to work on Sabbath. And so he described a little bit about the seniority system for air traffic controllers. And I felt like a doctor looking at a patient that you know is going to die in 6 months. And you don't want to say that. You know, you don't want to tell them you're going to die. Because I knew that violating a seniority agreement, particularly one like this, would be an undue hardship. He was undoubtedly not going to be able to pursue his career. His hopes and dreams, I knew, wouldn't happen. I went home and told my wife about this cute young couple here and his goals and how I just thought this was such a problem. I didn't say that to him. I described to him the nature of the law. But I didn't say to him, and you will surely lose. I didn't say that to him. Well, roll the clock forward 6 years. I'm sitting now in the law school office, and I get a call from Matthew Gray. I say, Matthew Gray, I remember you. He says, oh, yeah. He said, I've got a serious religious liberty problem, and I'd like to have you help me. And so I'm thinking, are you working for the FAA? Are you an air traffic controller? And if so, have you been working on Sabbath? He said to me, I've never worked on Sabbath. 6 years I've worked for the FAA as an air traffic controller, and never once have I been forced to work on Sabbath. God has always worked it out. Friends, that was a moment. I was certain that this could not happen, and God worked it out for him. And so he told me a story about his current situation, which was worse than his former situation. And he said to me, you know, Bruce, in fact, when I first met Matthew and his wife, they were new converts to the church. So he said, you know, Bruce, I'm continually studying, you know, the Bible, studying the church. And he said, I read about a year ago the church's position on being a member of a labor union. And he said, I became convicted that that's what I should do. So he said, I wrote a nice little note to the union saying, hey, friends, it's my religious beliefs. I'm not opposed to the union. I have no hostility toward you. It's just my religious beliefs. Now, if you know anything about federal employees, you know there's absolutely no obligation on their part to either join the union or pay fees. It's completely voluntary. And so it should have been no problem to just write a letter. Turned out it was a big problem because the union official came to him, started shouting at him, giving him a hard time and saying, look, we helped you with the Sabbath. You have been unfaithful to us. And so here's what we're going to do. If you continue with this idea of not being a union member, we're going to get you assigned to work every Sabbath. And so Matthew Gray said, look, you know, this is what I think God calls me to do. I can't compromise. And so the union official went to the director at Matt's area. He's air traffic controller, the division for the Northern Virginia area and down this way. And the union official said, we want you to change Matthew Gray's job so he's assigned to work every Sabbath. And you know what that big backbone director said? He said, yes, sir, three bags full, and assigned him to work every Sabbath. So Matthew said, can you help me, Bruce? Friends, when you know, if you're an employer and you know, if you're a union and you know about an employee's religious beliefs, you can't schedule their work to violate their religious beliefs. You're required to accommodate them, not try to violate them. And so this action violated at least two federal laws. So I filed four lawsuits, two against the employer, the FAA, two against the union. And years later, when the dust settled, Matthew Gray had won, and he was not being assigned to work every Sabbath. Well, friends, because of the period of time that the litigation took, because of the period of time he had worked previously to the problem he called me about, he had enough seniority so that he no longer is faced with the conflict with working on Sabbath. So I will tell you, I am certain that Matthew Gray will retire as an air traffic controller, and he will have never violated his religious beliefs. It's a moment in time when you say, you know, dear God, how kind you were to him. Let me tell you about Carol Catter, another client, but before I tell you about Carol Catter, let me tell you about a client named Glenn Greenwood, because Glenn tells us how I came to Carol. Glenn Greenwood is a Ohio State employee, works for the EPA there, and he had religious objections to joining the union or paying fees. And so he just started looking on the internet. And there are a number of my writings on the internet about how you go about asking for a religious accommodation, how you go about, you know, working this out to try to eliminate the conflict with your conscience. So Matthew had just been reading my stuff and following my directions. I had never talked to him. I didn't know him. He had never met me. But just following the directions, he was able to get the United States to sue the state of Ohio and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to sue a statewide union called AFSCME. And when he had launched these two huge lawsuits, he decided, maybe this is something I can't handle on my own anymore. Maybe do-it-yourself is no longer going to work. So he called me up and he said, hey, Bruce, I've been reading your stuff. This is what happened. Do you think you can help me? So I, of course, helped him. We intervened in the federal litigation, and he won. This is not about him, though. Because the United States had sued the state of Ohio, there are all sorts of documents coming out of Ohio. It's called discovery. And we had a bunch of documents coming out of the State Employment Relations Board, which was tasked with deciding on religious accommodation requests. And so I'm looking at a number of these cases where the employees lost. They had asked for religious accommodation, had been denied, and there was one really recently, a lady named Carol Catter. And I'm looking at her case and the decision. It was only about a month before. It had Carol's name, her address, her telephone number on the charge. And so I'm sitting there in the office. And you know why she had been denied? She had been denied in a religious accommodation because she was not a member of the right church. She was a member of the wrong church. And so I knew this was illegal. This was an improper decision. And I'm asking myself, what should I do? How many of you get calls from people you don't know that want to sell you something or want to have you give them money or want you to do something or other? Can you imagine a call? Hi, I'm a lawyer. And I'd like to talk to you about so-and-so. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be that guy that calls and says, hi, I'm a lawyer. On the other hand, the Holy Spirit, I think, was working on my heart that I needed to call her. So I called her. I said, hi, I'm a lawyer, and I just read about your case. I'm looking at the document. And friends, this is a moment in time. It's a moment in time because Carol Catter, at that very moment that I called, was sitting in her sitting on her bed trying to figure out how she was going to work out her future. You see, she had just received a call from the chief lawyer for the Ohio Education Association, the teachers union, and that chief lawyer had said to her, if you don't change your church membership, you're not going to be accommodated. She had been teaching in the public schools for 20 years. She didn't want to give up her career. You know what church she was a member of? She was a Roman Catholic. She was devout Roman Catholic. She couldn't give up her church. And so she's sitting there thinking, what should I do? I don't want to give up being a Catholic, and I don't want to give up my career. And at that moment, I called her. And I said, well, Carol, I think this is illegal. They can't require you to change your church membership. Now, let me just put a footnote in here. Do you know what church they wanted her to join? Your church. The Seventh-day Adventist Church. The statutes describe the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So if she became a Seventh-day Adventist, or an Amish Mennonite would work, then she would be accommodated. Now, I assume that every one of you here would like to have all the Roman Catholics become Seventh-day Adventists. I know some of you used to be Roman Catholics, and you are now Adventists. But I also hope that there's not a single one of you here who thinks that anyone should become a Seventh-day Adventist because the government tells you you have to join the church or lose your job. I mean, clearly, we don't want that. And that was her situation. So I said, Carol, I said, I think we can fix this. So filed suit in federal court. The statute was declared unconstitutional. The church had lobbied it into effect. Sorry, church. but our church is a very strong church-state separation positions, and this statute and ones like it are an anomaly for sure. So Carol continued on. She is now retired as a teacher. She's still a faithful Roman Catholic. And so she was able to have this moment, and I think it's a moment of God, when I called her just at the most critical time. Let me give you another footnote. She had a teenage son who was reading the legal papers as we were going through the litigation. He became interested in this. He became a lawyer. He went to the Ohio State University School of Law, And he decided that during the summer he'd go to Regent to take a course from me. He studied the case of his mother in the course. And so he's off practicing law, and I assume he is also interested in religious liberty. Let me tell you about the third guy, Dr. Robert Resser. Dr. Robert Resser was a university professor at the University of Detroit. As the name suggests, it's in Michigan, right? Now, it sounds like it's a public school, right? Because it's the University of Detroit. It's not. It's a Catholic school. It's a school run by Jesuits. And so Dr. Resser was teaching there, and they had a contract with the teachers' union, the Michigan Education Association, that said everyone had to either join the union or pay the fees. And so Dr. Resser said, well, you know, as a university professor, I'm not sure I really want to be a member of the union, but I'm going to pay the fees. Until the day came when Dr. Resser found that the union was promoting abortion. Now, he's a Catholic. And as you know, Catholic Church is pro-life. And so this is a very serious matter for him. I got to tell you, the union denied that it was pro-abortion, but in the litigation it came out that there was a statewide referendum in Michigan about whether or not taxpayers would have to pay for the abortions that people had. You know who the number one contributor to that referendum was, that is to have state taxpayer-funded abortions? Not Planned Parenthood, not the National Organization of Women, but the Michigan Education Association. Doesn't that strike you as odd? Every union that I know wants to preserve the work product for its members. How can fewer children, fewer students, be helpful for a teachers' union? But that was their position. And so Dr. Resser said, I can't do this. I can't do this. So he went to the university, and he said, friends, you know, I'm a Catholic. I'm following Catholic social teaching here. I think this is a very grave matter. And you know what the Jesuit president of the University of Detroit did? He fired Dr. Resser. He's, as you can imagine, a Jesuit institution firing a Catholic professor because of his fidelity to Catholic social teaching garnered a lot of news, particularly among the conservative Catholic press. And so I want to tell you about that decision of Dr. Resser, because it is remarkable. Dr. Resser was like most of us. Well, I'm getting old now. Most of you. Where he had a house in suburbia. He had three kids. He had a wife, a dog, I assume, a car. You know, he had all these obligations that all of you have. And he had no present prospect of another job. And he said, I'm not going to compromise. And he got fired over it. What a man of faith. What a man of faith. He called me up after he got fired. Not before he got fired. He called me up after he got fired. I think I was on vacation, because I've got this recollection being on a phone in a car, and he told me a little bit about his situation. And in order to vindicate your rights under Title VII, you have to file a charge with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You have to file with the agency first, and then you can get into federal court. So I said to him, have you filed a charge against the union? He said, yes. I said, have you filed a charge against the university? He said, no. I said, I think you need to do that. You should do that right away. He did it the next day. Friends, that became a major point in the litigation later on. He filed the charge on the last possible day. Had he not spoken with me, had I not said to him, you need to file, you know, had he not acted promptly, he would have forever waived his rights against the university. So we went to federal court, the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, again filed a lawsuit on his behalf, thankfully, and we intervened, and we were litigating. And as we're litigating, we lost in the federal district court. We just lost. And so the day came when it was going to be argued before the U.S. Court of Appeals, the court right below the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm sitting in my hotel room, and I'm thinking about the importance of this, because if I lost, I would harm the religious beliefs of thousands of religious employees. If I won, I would help thousands of religious employees. Now, here's the reason why this case is so important. When I first started litigating, the Seventh-day Adventist Church had been litigating this case, this issue of whether or not church members had a right to be reasonably accommodated with regard to union dues and union membership. And they'd been winning their cases. And so the law was, if you were a member of a church, then you could be accommodated. That's really why this state statute said that. It's because this litigation background. Then the first advance, and I was involved in this, involved a lady in Washington State. She had religious beliefs like Seventh-day Adventists that she could never be a member of a church, a member of a union, anytime, any place, anywhere. But what? She wasn't a Seventh-day Adventist, and she wasn't even a member of her own church. And so the union fought her, and we won. In fact, it was council record when the case came to the U.S. Supreme Court. We won. And so that was the first expansion. You didn't have to be a Seventh-day Adventist. Now imagine Dr. Resser's case. Dr. Resser's not a Seventh-day Adventist. If you looked at the Catholic Church, you would say the Catholic Church is pro-union. He didn't have a per se objection to unions. It was only because the union was involved in this one activity. If they had stopped being involved in that activity, that would have eliminated his religious objection. So his case was the next step forward. His case would be representative of thousands and thousands of employees across the United States. So I'm sitting there thinking about the importance of this, and I'm praying about it. And there's a Gideon's Bible there. And I opened the Gideon's Bible, and the page said something like this: consider it as if you've already won. You know, consider as if God has already given you the victory. Did that help me? You bet it did. That was a moment in time. I'll tell you, friends, I've looked in the Bible. I've never been able to find that text in the Old Testament. There's one like in the New Testament, but not in the Old Testament. That's where I was. So I walked across the street to the court. They called my case. I stood before the court, and it's a three-judge court. And guess who is the lead judge in the case? A guy who I knew was hostile to our litigation. He didn't like the Right to Work Foundation. He didn't like our litigation. And he's the chief of the panel. But here's the good news. I also knew that years ago, he had ruled on behalf of a Seventh-day Adventist who had religious objections to supporting a labor union. And so I started my argument, right? And pretty soon, this chief judge said to me, "We've read your briefs, Mr. Cameron. We've considered the matter, and I'll paraphrase, sit down and shut up." You don't have to finish your argument. So I indeed sat down and I shut up. And when the union lawyer got up, they were pummeling him. When the university lawyer got up, they were pummeling him. And it was shortly thereafter that they issued a decision ruling completely in Dr. Resser's favor. What a blessing. What a wonderful thing. Now, you may be saying to yourself, the guy lost his job. All those years you were litigating, was he on the breadlines? Within 6 months after he was fired by the university, he got a job with General Motors, paid twice as much as he was at the university. God was faithful to him. He was faithful to him in the case. He was faithful to him in the practical aspects of life. Friends, Matthew 6:33 says this: seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. God says to us, you know, seek my will first, and I will give you what the pagans are running after. Matthew Gray was faithful. God protected him. Cal Catter was faithful. God protected her. Robert Resser was faithful. Robert Resser decided, although because he won, he could have gone back to the University of Detroit, he decided to stay with General Motors. I know he's now retired from General Motors, which is the advantage of being an old guy like me. You actually see how these cases ultimately work out. My challenge to you is this: whatever the issue is, whatever the conflict is in life, God says, be faithful to me, and I will be faithful to you.
If we could all stand for this final song, and we can start enjoying this, the rest of the Sabbath day and this great weekend that we have coming up.
Thank you.
Yeah.